going to have our reading for this morning. And it might look a bit random because we're in Galatians, but we are continuing in our Genesis series. And this is a connected reading. Andrew will be continuing with the reading on Genesis. And just to help us understand how it's connected. Well, first of all, let me tell you where it is. Sorry. It's Galatians chapter 4. So Galatians chapter 4 and starting in verse 21. And we're reading through to 31. So that's Galatians chapter 4. And if you're looking in the church Bible, that's page 974. So back to how it's connected. You'll see that it's talking about Abraham's two sons. And just to help us understand the terms that are used, you'll see that Paul, when he's talking to the Galatian church about Abraham's two sons, he talks about the son of the slave woman, and that is Ishmael. And he talks about the son of the free woman, and that is Isaac. And he also talks about him as the child of the promise. So we're in Galatians chapter 4 and starting at verse 21. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not listen to the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. Now this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery, and she is Hagar. Now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. For it is written, Rejoice, O barren one who does not bear. Break forth and cry aloud, you who are not in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband. Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, so also it is now. But what does the scripture say? Cast out the slave woman and her son. For the son of the slave woman shall not inherit with the son of the free woman. So, brothers, we are not children of the slave, but of the free woman.
Thanks very much, Claire. Deeply Bibles open, we're going to be looking out at Genesis 21, and it's on page 15 in Church Bibles for the inside of your sheet, if you prefer. Thank you so much, Philia. And while you're looking that up, lots of us know this from the WhatsApp group, but I'm delighted to announce that the reason Chris and Chelsea are not here is that baby Kift was born Friday night. He's called Emmanuel David John, and he came in at £10.04. So wonderful that he's arrived, and do be praying for them. Let me carry on in our reading, and we're going to read from verse 8 of chapter 21. And the child, which is the child Isaac, the child of promise, the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, that's Ishmael, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac shall your offspring be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring. So Abraham rose early in the morning, took bread and skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba.
When the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot, for she said, "Let me not look on the death of the child." And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Ah, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make him into a great nation." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So I'm told that in the world of financial planning, and we do have some financial planners amongst us and others involved in investments, so they can put us right if I'm wrong, but I'm told that it is always sensible to hedge your bets, i.e. not to put all the eggs in one basket. And it's obvious why, because if that basket goes down, you lose everything. So the common sense thing is to diversify. And I think this is one of the great major planks of investment planning. However, hedging our bets is not such a good strategy necessarily in other areas. It's certainly not a good thing relationally. And we probably know there are people, usually men, who have multiple partners, even multiple families. Here's a guy, I don't know this guy, he's called Joe, he's from Utah, found him on the internet. He's married to two sisters, twin sisters, and their cousin. I met a guy actually while I was traveling in rural Tanzania called Clinton, who was in a similar situation. He was a bigamist. He had two wives, two separate families who lived in two houses on the same road. And however you run it, hedging your bets romantically is always going to be a recipe for problems. And actually, I just know this guy, and Clinton was honest enough to admit that his arrangement had some very serious drawbacks in terms of family unity, as you'd guess. So if hedging our bets is sensible in some areas, and yet it's not sensible in others, the question we're going to be thinking about today is this one. Should we hedge our bets spiritually? If you're not a Christian, you might not have thought about that question much before, but perhaps instinctively you think, well, yes, perhaps there is some sense in covering your bases, a little bit like the financial question. And yet, I guess if you are a Christian, when you hear that question, instinctively you want to say no. Most people don't, do they, and try and straddle their horses, multiple horses, religiously. You don't find people who, well, I worship God, you know, Allah on Fridays, I worship a Hindu God on Saturdays, and I worship Jesus on Sundays. It's not very common that you hear that. And yet, whilst we don't hedge our bets in that way, I hope, I wonder whether actually we do hedge our bets in a different way, perhaps unknowingly. So perhaps, you know, when it comes to salvation and eternal life, well, yeah, I leave Jesus with that stuff. But when it comes to other issues, when it comes to security in life, well, basically, I trust my bank account. Or when it comes to satisfaction, well, I trust my partner or I trust my family. Or when it comes to fulfillment, I trust my career or my network or my reputation to deliver. And whereas it's all, you know, it's very, very obvious if we're trying to straddle multiple horses religiously, you know, Jesus plus Allah, Jesus plus Vishnu, it can be less obvious when we're trying to straddle multiple horses spiritually, you know, Jesus plus money, Jesus plus relationships. And today we are carrying on our series in the life of Abraham, and we're coming to an episode in Abraham's life where Abraham discovers two crucial things, which are going to be crucial for us as well. And they are these, that the Lord calls us to trust him alone. He says, no hedging our bets with him. And he says that when we do that, we can trust him with the consequences. So first, let's look at point number one. The Lord calls us to trust in him alone. If you're with us last week, you'll know we just had that high point in the Abraham narrative where the child of promise, Isaac, is born. Lord has kept his promise, his hilarious promise, Sarah, this 90-year-old barren woman, she gives birth to a child. And yet pretty soon, and we saw this last week, there was a dark cloud on the horizon. And our passage begins in verse 8 with Isaac's weaning festival. And Ishmael, who's Abraham's firstborn son, instead of laughing with Sarah and Isaac and delighting in God's grace and God's promises, Ishmael laughs at Isaac. And he refuses to rejoice in God's promise. And he refuses to delight that it's through Isaac that salvation and blessing are going to come to the world. So that's a little recap from last week. And we're going to pick up the narrative now in verse 10. And the story goes next in what I would say is a pretty shocking direction. So let's see what happens, verse 10. So, that means on seeing Ishmael's mocking of Isaac, Sarah said to Abraham, "Cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac." And this phrase here, "son of the slave woman," it's a reminder of Ishmael's origins. And you'll know about this if you've been with us for the whole series. Ishmael was born as a result of Abraham and Sarah's sin. Instead of trusting God, instead of patiently waiting for his promise to be fulfilled, you'll remember they took that grubby shortcut and they arranged for Sarah's maidservant Hagar to go in and conceive a child with Abraham to try and speed up the whole process. And Ishmael, Hagar's son, would now be about 13 years old. And Sarah perceives from Ishmael's mocking in verse 10 that Ishmael is going to be a threat to her son Isaac and a threat to his inheritance. And so she wants Ishmael out of the picture. Just send him away. It's worth saying, I mean, this is a big, it's very uncommon, obviously, this sort of scenario in our age. But it's worth saying that it was a very normal and culturally acceptable thing at that time that if a slave bears a child, as Hagar does in this case, the head of the household can grant freedom to that slave in exchange for the slave's child relinquishing any claim on the family's inheritance. And that's the proposal Sarah's making here. She's saying that Hagar can go free, but Ishmael, Hagar's son, he can therefore have no inheritance with Isaac. And I guess immediately we are, you know, tuned into the rights and wrongs of the situation, and especially what is Sarah doing here? Is she got it? She acts in quite an unkind way. I want to say the writer, Moses, is not so interested in that question as we are. He's focused on something else. He's focused on how the Lord uses this situation in Abraham's life, as we're going to see. Incidentally, there are other examples in the Bible. You can find it in 1 Samuel 8. The people ask for a king, and they are wrong. They act sinfully to ask for a king, but the Lord supports their decision. And he says, yes, they were wrong to ask for it, but I'm going to further my plans through it. And actually, the book of Genesis, if you know the book, it ends with a kind of climactic statement in the last chapter saying what humans intend for good, for evil, God can and does use for good. So we don't have to kind of assume that Sarah's behavior is commendable here just because the Lord uses this situation in Abraham's life, if that was what we were thinking. So let's keep going. The thing, verse 11, was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. He's sad about this idea of having to give up Ishmael. Verse 12, but God said to Abraham, "Be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac shall your offspring be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring." So we must remember not only that this child Ishmael was a result of disobedience from Abraham, but also that it's been the Lord's promise throughout that this covenant family would come into being, not as a result of human efforts, which is what Ishmael represents, but as a result of grace, God's miraculous sovereign grace, which is what Isaac represents. And so the Lord tells Abraham to agree to Sarah's request, whilst making sure that Ishmael doesn't get shortchanged through the process, which is what the Lord underlines in verse 13. So I know that's took a bit of explanation. That is a summary of the events. I hope we're up to speed with the kind of basic storyline of what's happened. And next we're going to think about the meaning of those events for us. And as I said at the beginning, I think what the key point of this passage is the Lord is communicating to Abraham and us that he wants us to trust him alone. But I want to persuade you why I think that is the main point. And that may take a little bit of explanation. So just keep going. One of the things I've been puzzling over as I've been preparing this is the way this chapter, chapter 21, it deliberately pairs with the more famous chapter that comes after it. The chapter after this one, Genesis 22, is a very famous Bible story where Abraham is tested by God. He's called to sacrifice his son, Isaac. And if you know the story, Abraham is obedient to God's call. And then at the last minute, the Lord intervenes. And instead of Isaac being sacrificed, the Lord produces a substitute, a ram, who dies in Isaac's place. Very significant point in the Bible storyline. Actually, this picture behind me, Josie took me to see it once. It was actually on our honeymoon in Florence in the Uffizi. And I was so captivated by this picture and how it communicated the kind of gritty violence of the moment that I went and bought loads of postcards of it afterwards because I just enjoyed it so much. And when you read these two chapters, you can't miss that these two stories, the one with Ishmael and the one with Isaac, are being paired. They're parallel. They're deliberately told in a parallel way. And I'm just going to show you that now. So in these accounts, I've jumped one, but we can do two at a time. The Lord commands a journey involving one of Abraham's sons. So in one chapter, it's Ishmael, and the other chapter, it's Isaac. Then, next thing that happens, Abraham rises early in the morning to provide for the journey. Next thing that happens, Abraham is required to give up the son, in one case Ishmael, in the other case Isaac, before, next thing that happens, just as the son's about to die, the angel of the Lord intervenes to save the child. Then eyes are mentioned which see the Lord's life-giving provision, before finally the scene concludes with the promise of great descendants through the nearly lost son. The point is that you can't miss when you read them that they are deliberately being paired. They should be read together. And I've been puzzling why that is. And I think the reason is because they are effectively part one and part two of a big test for Abraham. We know chapter 22 is a test. We're actually told that explicitly in the first verse of chapter 22. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, and on it goes. And one of the things that's emphasized in the test in chapter 22 is that in being called to give up Isaac, Abraham is being called to give up his son, his only son. And you get that phrase repeated three times in the chapter, his son, his only son. But in order for that test to be so difficult, his only son, we have to have the events of chapter 21 first. Do you see that? Abraham needs to be ready to give up the first son, Ishmael, and send him away first as part one of the test before we can get on to part two, giving up his only son in chapter 22. Incidentally, here's another picture of Abraham sending Ishmael away. This is a European, 19th century European painter, Joseph Molnar, and I say that just to explain why they are both European and 19th century in their dress. It's a bit of a long one. I don't think they look like that. And the reason chapter 21 is a test for Abraham is because in sending Ishmael away, Abraham is being called to put all his trust in the child of promise, in Isaac. So God had promised before that through this toddler, through Isaac, the child of promise, God's salvation is going to come to the whole world. It's through Isaac's line that the serpent crusher will come, the Messiah. And Abraham is being told that to have real faith, he cannot keep Ishmael as a backup plan. Abraham has been called here to put all his eggs in the Isaac basket. He has to be all in trusting God. And of course, this is the decision that believers have faced ever since, isn't it? Yes, I'm happy to trust Jesus. I love the idea of, you know, having the Jesus insurance policy in my back pocket in case I ever need it, you know, if I'm suddenly about to die or something. You know, I've got, but I also need my backup plan as well. So yes, Jesus has promised to care for me, but mainly I'm going to trust in money and career and connections and my family to get me through. And Jesus just might be a useful backup if everything else falls apart. And crucially, this is what we're seeing in this chapter, is that God very often puts these tests in our lives, as he does with Abraham here, where we have to choose. We can't straddle two horses anymore. And the test for us might mean saying no to something. It might be saying no to a relationship which we know isn't God's will for us, and therefore trusting that God's ways are best, even when it's very costly. Or the test might be drawing a line at work. I won't sign off on that, or I won't wear that rainbow lanyard and endorse that ideology. Or it might mean drawing a line in a particular friendship group. Yeah, I love hanging out with you guys, but I can't join in with the gossip. I can't laugh at the same jokes that you laugh at. Or I can't join in when everyone's grumbling at the boss. And often it's not until the test comes that we know whether we're trusting in God alone or not. So only when the test comes that we realize we have been trying to hedge our bets, and we have actually been trying to straddle two horses all along. So we've been trying to straddle the God horse and another horse, the God horse and the career horse, or the God horse and the popularity horse, or whatever it is. And God, in his kindness, he puts these crunch situations in our life, which I guess in this would be, you know, having to go under a low bridge, you know, something that means he has to choose which horse. He has to jump one way or the other. There's often a pressure on young people from unbelieving families when they're told it's fine for you to go to church, just so long as you're not fanatical about it. Don't let God interfere with your priorities or your ambitions. And in saying that, it's worth getting underneath what is really being said. And what is really being said is that Jesus is the equivalent of the bid on the side. He's the second partner. He's the affair. It's fine. You can have your Jesus thing. You can have your affair, so long as you don't take the affair too seriously and let it take over. And Jesus says, no, that's not how it works. If you're going to be in relationship with me, it means, and this is what Esther and Milton said to one another 9 days ago in a glorious moment, they said, forsaking all others, I will be faithful to you, whatever the cost. Hopefully, you've witnessed that in many marriage services, as I have, and it's a wonderful moment. And that is what it means to be in relationship with God. And he refuses to be a bit on the side. He says, forsake all others and have me alone. And actually, it's no surprise that this narrative then becomes a key part of Paul's argument to the Galatian Christians in the New Testament. Claire gave us this reading from Galatians. And if you know that letter, you'll know that Christians in that context were, they loved having Jesus in their lives, but they wanted to have Jesus as the bit on the side. They wanted to cover their bases. They wanted Jesus plus. So I trust Jesus, plus I trust in my religious performance as a way of being right with God. And Paul, in a brilliant move, he takes him right back to this story. And he says, do you not know the Abraham story? You think you're being true to the children of Abraham by insisting on Jesus plus religious performance, Jesus plus circumcision in that context. But I'll tell you who you really are in that story. If you want to put confidence in human performance, you are effectively children of Hagar. You're children of the slave woman. And you're the ones in the story, therefore, who end up being excluded from God's family. Because it's only those who put their confidence in God's grace alone who are the true children of Abraham. And actually, as we read that Galatians narrative, it confirms we are on the right track in reading Genesis in this way. So the big message for this episode is this. Abraham has to learn, we have to learn, the Lord calls us to trust in him alone. And I guess this is a call for us to be thinking in our own lives, where are we tempted to be trying to ride two horses? And then to be being careful not to do that. But there's more, because there's these verses also help Abraham and they help us see that when we do that, when we jump onto one horse, we can also trust him with the consequences. So, we've already established this whole situation has come about because of Abraham's sin. We've also established that it's the Lord's will that Ishmael is going to be sent away. So what are we expecting next? And I want to suggest that we might expect that that would be the last we would hear of Hagar and Ishmael. But what we actually see is this incredible tenderness that the Lord shows these two outsiders, Hagar and Ishmael. So let's pick up. If you're starting to nod off, if your neighbor is giving a good elbow, I know it's a hot day. Stay with us. We're looking at verse 14. So Abraham rose early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, let me not look on the death of the child. So he's run out of all his resources. He's about to die. And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. This is lovely, verse 17. And God heard the voice of the boy. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Up, lift up the boy. Hold him fast with your hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water, gave the boy a drink, and God was with the boy. And he grew up, he lived in the wilderness, became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So remember Ishmael, he has acted very, very badly. He set himself against Isaac. He set himself against God's purposes. He's been sent away. And yet, despite this, we see this incredible act of, this episode of kindness towards him. And you see it again and again. God hears his prayer, 17. He promises him blessing, verse 18. He's going to become a great nation. He sends an angel and provides for him, verse 19. He's with him. In verse 20. And so we're asking the question, what are we meant to do with this? This incredible kindness and tenderness which the Lord is showing here to this undeserving outsider. And I've been grappling with this question. Are we just meant to see that God is kind? And of course we know that, don't we? The Lord is good to all, Psalm 145. His mercy is over all that he has made. Is this an illustration of God's wonderful kindness? Or is it because we're learning about God's particular care for outsiders? Well, possibly. But actually, the big clue here as to why God is being so kind to Ishmael comes here in verse 13. Look with me. God says to Abraham, I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also. Why? Because he is your offspring. Do you see the point? Ishmael isn't representing outsiders in general here. The reason Ishmael's being shown this exceptional kindness is because of his relationship to Abraham. And actually this fits, doesn't it, with this emphasis in the whole chapter about what God is teaching Abraham in this chapter. Abraham is the one who's been given this test by God. He's been called to trust in God alone. And therefore this kindness to Ishmael is here to reinforce that when Abraham does that, when Abraham puts all his eggs in the Isaac basket, God can then be trusted to pour out his grace and to show wonderful kindness in sorting out the consequences. Let me just show you that in verses 12 and 13. Abraham, verse 12, whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you. That's the command. Trust God alone, put him first. And then verse 13. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he's your offspring. There's the assurance. Do the command, and this is the assurance that accompanies it. Abraham, trust me, and you can know that I will sort out the rest. I know you love Ishmael, and I will make sure he gets special care. And this is such a practical teaching for you and me, isn't it? I think this is very often the big question we face with lots of difficulties, tests in our lives. Yes, I know that God calls me to do that thing, to break off that relationship. But then what will happen to that person spiritually if I'm the only Christian they know and I've broken off? And God says, put me first. Leave me to sort out the consequences. Or we say, well, yeah, I can draw that line, but what if, you know, I decide not to compromise in that situation? What about if I lose my job? Or what about if I, you know, stall and don't ever get promoted again? What about looking after my family? And God says, put me first and leave the rest to me. Or we think, what about if I live distinctively in that friendship group? You know, if I don't get drunk or gossip or grumble, well, I'll just be shunned. I'll lose my friends. And what's more, they will lose the only Christian in their lives, perhaps. And God says, put me first. Leave me to sort out the consequences. And actually realizing this about God is essential for us if we want to live a wholehearted Christian life in all kinds of different areas. I was thinking about a friend of mine. This is quite a small thing, but it's very practical. Whenever he's in his car and he's late for a meeting, he says this prayer. He says, Lord, I'm going to trust you. I'm not going to break the speed limit right now. And therefore, I'm trusting that you will sort out the mess at the other end if I arrive late. It's just a very practical application of this thing. Put God first and leave the rest to him. Or at the other end of the high-stakes scale, I was thinking of this week of the wonderful Puritan and writer of Pilgrim's Progress, this guy John Bunyan. Bunyan famously was imprisoned in Bedford Jail in 1660 for preaching without state approval. It was forbidden just to preach without a license, and the authorities wanted to make an example of him. And so they agreed to release him at any moment if he agreed not to preach again. And they were hoping that, you know, he's such a big figure, others would follow his example and would just stop preaching the gospel, and that would silence the Christians. But of course, Bunyan believed that God was calling him to stand against that godless law. And so he chose day by day to stay locked up, day after day. He could have got out at any moment, and he stayed in the prison for 12 long years. And what made that decision so hard for Bunyan, and especially for his incredible wife, Elizabeth, was she was of the same mind as him. They held the same convictions. They had four children under 12, and the eldest, Mary, was born blind, and they had very little money to care for her. And so Bunyan was making the decision daily to be absent for much of their childhood. And Bunyan described it very evocatively of how saying goodbye to him when they got to visit him in prison, and he said especially saying goodbye to dear Mary, was like having the flesh pulled from off his bones. And yet he felt he had to take this stand for the sake of conscience and for the sake of the gospel. And we want to ask the question, why? How did he do that? He had this intense pressure on him to give in, and yet he held out. How did he do it? And of course, the answer is what we've been seeing in this chapter. He knew that if you put God first, God can be trusted with the rest. And that for Bunyan was a hard decision, but he knew the Lord could be trusted with his family in his absence, and so he persisted. And understanding this truth has enabled Christian bravery in all kinds of situations and tests. And especially I was thinking of how this truth has really released so many martyrs to be faithful right to the end. So when you think of martyrs, we forget possibly that actually they often had a choice. Martyrs often could recant. And often they have good reason to maybe take that line. I've got so many responsibilities. And, you know, what about those I'm going to leave behind? Perhaps the sensible thing is to make sure that I'm responsible to them. And yet it's always the responsible thing, actually, to put God first. and then leave the rest to him. And this chapter's got such an incredibly practical message for each one of us, that the Lord is nobody's debtor. When he calls us to do something, he will pour out grace and kindness, and we can trust the situation to him. I think what must have made this episode especially significant and comforting for Abraham, you know, as he heard about how the Lord was going to make Ishmael into this great nation because of Abraham, Abraham must have been very aware that this whole situation with Ishmael was actually Abraham's mess. It was actually brought about by his sin with Hagar. There's a well-known joke, this might lie some things, I feel there's a kind of heavy heat in this room, but there's a story about a tourist in Ireland, and he asked one of the locals if he can give him directions to Dublin. And the Irishman replies, to be sure, to Dublin, you say, but if I were going to Dublin, I wouldn't start from here. And then, with apologies for the stereotyping and the accent. Can I say that God is never like that. God never says, I've got some advice for you, but you mustn't start from here. God always comes to us in the midst of our mess and says, here is where you obey me. In fact, the Bible addresses us in the very real, very messy situations where we actually are. And God calls us to trust him in the middle of that mess. Often those messes are things that we have a hand in creating. That was certainly the case for Abraham. This whole mess in my life is because I made the mess. And yet God comes to us in the mess and he says, trust me. In fact, he says to Abraham, this situation with Hagar and Ishmael, it's obviously going to have consequences. Things are not going to be the same in your family anymore, or in your marriage. This is not going to be simple for you, Abraham. It will mean painful situations down the line. And this is what Abraham's experiencing here. But Abraham, there is still a way to live a godly life that gives me glory in the midst of this mess. And what's more, you can trust me. As you put me first in each situation, I will pour out abundant grace and blessing on you, and I can sort out the consequences. And I wonder whether that's a particular word for some of us in this room. You know, we look around and we say, well, it's fine for all those shiny people at Grace Church. Now, incidentally, I've yet to find out who the shiny people are. Because I know quite a lot of you, and everyone I know is a sinner. We've all got our own issues. Anyways, people think it's okay for those people, but it's not okay for me. It's too late for me. My problems are just too naughty. Are too difficult. My problems are too stubborn for God. And Jesus says, nonsense. I have come to call the righteous to repentance. I didn't come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance is what Jesus says. And Jesus, the only people Jesus has any dealings with at all are broken and sinful people. The only type of people there are, actually. It's Jesus' specialty. It's what he does. And therefore, we can trust him in the middle of whatever situations we're in. And so we started with that question, should we hedge our bets spiritually? And I think we've seen that thinking we can do that, that we can hedge our bets spiritually, is as disastrous as thinking that we can hedge our bets relationally and have multiple marriages and think it's all going to be okay. In fact, the Lord, like any worthy husband, he calls us to trust him alone. And he will bring situations into our lives which call us to make that decision, where forsaking all others, we have to put him first. And he puts these situations in for our good to help us jump onto the right horse. And as we do that, we can trust him and we can know that he is with us, he is for us. And whatever costs there might be, and there are considerable costs often when we put him first, we can trust him to pour out abundant grace and blessing into our lives. I'm going to leave a moment's quiet. There will be a Q&A a little bit later after our prayers. But why don't we use the quiet just to come before God and to resolve to trust him, ask him to put a spotlight and expose where we're riding two horses and help us to jump on the right one. Let's have a bit of quiet now.